Welcome to Cracked, the podcast, the program that slays the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, embarrassment, fear, and stigma. Because mental health isn't something that affects just some of us, it applies to all of us. Here to shine a new light on areas of mental health that often go unvisited are your hosts, Rebecca Shaper and Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello, and welcome to the very first edition of Cracked, the podcast, Slaying the Dragons of Mental Health, with me, Sandy Sedgebeer.
And me, Rebecca Shaper.
And we're delighted to be kicking off this new podcast series with internationally respected psychotherapist Malcolm Stern, whose latest book, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, inspired the subtitle for this podcast. Now, Malcolm originally trained in humanistic psychology, and he's been working as a group and individual psychotherapist for more than 30 years. He's a co-director and co-founder of Alternatives, the world-renowned platform for leading spiritual teachers and alternative thinking at St. James Church in London. In addition to running psychotherapy groups and courses internationally, he also teaches occasionally at the SLN Institute in California and Findhorn in Scotland. Malcolm joins us today to talk about his work and his latest book, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which shares 10 ways to thrive, even when it feels impossible. Malcolm Stern, welcome.
Thank you very much, Sandy and Rebecca.
Malcolm, with your permission, we'd like to start by addressing a subject that's becoming increasingly prevalent, and that's suicide. And since this is something that you and Rebecca both have very close personal experience of, I'm going to let Rebecca lead this particular segment.
Hello, Malcolm. In 2014, your oldest daughter, Melissa, took her own life. It's one thing to have the skills to help others cope with such a tragedy. It's quite another to lose your own daughter in such a painful and tragic manner. And the reason why I say that is because I understand how it is to lose a loved one, because both my parents died by suicide. So my question to you, Malcolm, how did you cope? And what was your first reaction when you found out about this?
Well, my first reaction, and I've since sort of been exploring this with other people who've gone through similar experiences, was numbness. And it was almost like a disbelief. Yeah. And for quite a while afterwards, I kept thinking I was seeing Melissa in the street, or I would hear from her, or something would happen. But actually, it was, I think that the body for me shut down quite a lot for a while the numbness wore in and the shock wore on. And then at a certain stage, bit by bit, it came to, which I think is actually one of the geniuses of the body, that it allows you to let this stuff in gradually. Because I've seen people who've gone to the other extreme where they've been decimated, unable to get off the floor, sobbing and crying for months and months.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a defense mechanism that your body's doing. That's kind of how. So my next question to you is, what if somebody really, truly wants to die by suicide? And the other person is trying to say, no, I love you. Please don't take your life. You have purpose here. What would you say to that person who... it's done, over. They want to do it, that's it, and they've done it. Do you feel, can you explain that? I'm curious.
I had two clients come to me more than 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Both of whom said to me they were going to commit suicide. And one of them said to me, I'm going to take my life, and if you're here to stop me doing that, I'm not interested in coming into therapy with you. I'm not interested in stopping you doing that. I think we need to have some structure around this. So if you're going to work with me, then I don't want to have any terrible surprises. But actually, I'm willing to work with you on this process and to see what emerges. And we had an extraordinary time working, because I didn't think you cannot do this. In my mind, if you want to do this, I mean, obviously, I'm not close to her in the way that one would be to a loved one. But if you want to do this, then I'm able to support you in that process too.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I'm sure that's very helpful to the audience as well, because I'm sure they're in situations like that.
Well, the interesting thing is with this woman is that she was smoking 60 cigarettes a day. And after I'd been working with her for about 3 years, and the deal I had with her was that she had to let me know when she was going to do the deed, if she was going to do the deed, mm-hmm. I had to know in advance. I wouldn't alert anyone and I wouldn't stop her, but she had to let me know so that I wasn't suddenly shocked by it. Not because I'm too weak to be shocked by it, but just because there was a contract between us.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was that she developed terminal lung cancer. Mm. And suddenly she wanted to live. And so suddenly when the stuff happens where you're about to sort of go, I can't stand it anymore, something comes and says, you haven't got a choice anymore. And then for the next year of her life, she lived the life of Riley. She traveled around the world. She had sex with people. She was just having a wild time. And eventually the cancer got to the point where she couldn't handle it anymore. And she told me that she was going to take her life the next Wednesday. And that and she told me how she was going to do it. And she did.
Oh, wow. Good story. So my next question to you is, Malcolm, you mentioned it took Melissa a year to recover from her last breakdown, and it appeared as though it would never recur. Do you feel Melissa's job working with children who were vulnerable, seriously abused, and had extreme behavioral problems caused her to plummet in her darkest depression? Or do you feel she was a very empathic person and was picking up the energy of these kids? And hold on, I got one more. Perhaps maybe she was just absorbing all the pain, and this was kind of the catalyst of her dark depression. That she just couldn't take it anymore, that she was just picking up all the pain, and it just, I'll let you proceed.
Well, interestingly, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which is my book, was originally going to be called Journey of an Empath, which was about Melissa's empathic journey.
Oh, I got goosebumps.
And so, yeah, I got goosebumps as I said it as well. She was very, very finely tuned. And of course, when we're finely tuned, we're much more likely to tread into territory that's going to rock our boat more strongly than someone who's more earthed and less compassionate. When we're highly compassionate, I think we have to, or highly empathic, we have to develop ourselves so that we are not going to be thrown over by the inevitable knocks of life that life is going to bring our way.
Malcolm, can I ask a question here? You've written that you really believe that if Melissa hadn't had such a traumatic early experience of mental health services, she wouldn't have been scared of seeking help when she became unwell again. Is it so bad? I mean, are the services so poor?
Well, her experience was so bad. And she was in intensive care psychiatric, and I went to visit her there. She had bruises all over her arms and legs where she was held down. They drugged her up to the eyeballs so that she could hardly stand, because they just wanted to. I'm sure that these mental health services have changed over the years, but when this was happening to her, she was brutalized by the system. And she was determined never to go there again, and never to touch medication, never to be diagnosed again. She was diagnosed as being bipolar. But I think these diagnoses are a way of putting people in comfortable compartments. And the diagnosis is not the truth of everything that's going on. And what we often need in those scenarios is compassion and connection.
Oh, so true. I hear you. I definitely understand where you're coming from. Wow. It's good. I just can't imagine what she was going through in the hospital. It just blows me away, because my mother had the same situation.
Yes.
So that's why I relate so much to you. And so.
So, looking at the statistics, it seems that since the 1950s, young adults, certainly here in the UK, have become three times more likely to commit suicide. And that 3/4 of registered deaths in the UK in 2018 were among men, which has been the case since the mid-1990s. Of course, in the last year, we've seen, you know, a few more escalations. Why do you think it seems to be affecting men more than women?
I think women are better. This is one of the chapters in my book, is about creating a sangha, creating a community. And I think that for men, it's much harder to be able to find spaces where they can share their feelings, where they can get empathic and emotionally wise supports. We're not used to, as men, being trained into emotional sort of articulacy. And that's, I think, where a lot of the problem is, that we need to create environments where it's safe to say more than, how are you? I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah. How has your experience with Melissa informed, transformed the work that you're doing in the therapy room?
Well, it's enormous, because I think it takes, often it takes some great shock to shift us. And I was working with someone the other day, it's interesting, people who come to me, you know, I've got two clients I'm working with at the moment whose children took their own lives in the last year. And I was working with someone the other day, and she was saying, you know, I know that if I was with another therapist, I'd have to keep checking to see whether or not they could tune into what I was going through, because they hadn't been there. I know with you, you know the territory, and you've been there. And that's what's important, is that we can bring what we experience back into the territory. So it took me a long time. This isn't like I went, you know, the day after she killed herself, I went, oh, great, now I'll be able to work with people in those scenarios. But actually, I feel like I've been given something at the same time as being, you know, absolutely smashed over the head with this. I've also been given something that's helped me develop, and I know that I've been to almost as bad a place as a human being can go to, and survived and found my way through, and then I can help others to find their way through from that perspective.
Mm. You know, what was the inspiration for Slay Your Dragons then?
Melissa's death was the inspiration.
Melissa's death was.
And actually what happened is I started even 2 days after she died, I wrote a poem that I put on Facebook as a way of letting people know that she died. And I'm not a great poet, but it's like it came from the heart, and it just flooded through me. And so I wrote this poem and a way of letting people know, and I had the most beautiful responses from people. And I realized I wanted to write, and I started, you know, quite soon after trying to write some stuff around it, and it wasn't hanging together. And it took me it was 4 years later that I met up with three young people who were in my group, all of whom were highly empathic. And we talked about setting up support structures for people who were empaths. And then I said, I actually feel like I could write a book for people who are empaths. And that was where the inspiration landed, that actually this was so the inspiration was really, write a book about people who are empaths. Now, my friend Ben Crabe and I worked on this book, and bit by bit, it took us a year and a half, we structured it in such a way to realize that it wasn't any longer about empaths. What it was how do you thrive when life throws everything at you? What are the structures we need in order to be able to not just survive, but to thrive, to become strong, and to be able to embrace what we've been through and bring it into a new dimension?
How did you come up with the 10 ways? I mean,
yeah,
where did they come from?
My publishers, to Watkins Books, who have published this book, I said, I hate these 10 ways to do this, 7 ways to do that, 8 ways to do that. But then after a while, we started to realize, well, there are a number of ways, and actually there are 10 ways, but well, why not say it like it is? There are 10 ways that I've experienced. So what I realized with this book is that I've written myself a manual that these are the practices I need to go through in order to be able to handle life's inevitable storms and difficulties and disillusionments and horrors.
I have a quick question to ask you. Do you feel like people who are very empathic have a lot of trauma in their life?
100% they do. Because I think the more thick-skinned we are, the less we're penetrated by things. Yeah. I think at the same time we get less joy from life. Mm-hmm. But I think if we're to learn to navigate life's journey as highly empathic people, which I think is one of the things I was looking at in the initial book idea was that we're on an evolutionary journey, and that the next stage of evolution, it may be Homo empathicus, that, you know, that actually it may be that we need to become so much more empathic in order to be able to be more wholesome and in order to create the next stage of evolution. But I think it's a very rocky journey. And I think we've got to learn to manage that empathic journey. But certainly it gives us the potential to have a lot of joy with people.
What would you say to people who are so blocked that they can't touch, they can't touch inside and be empathic? I believe there are souls out there that their energy is just so blocked that they can't go further. They can't.
Do you know, Rab Dass, who's someone I studied with for quite a long time, who's a wonderful man who's recently passed over to the other side. He used to say, if you're in a relationship, and this is bigger than relationship, but this is quite an interesting statement. He said, if you're in a relationship and you're waking up and the person you're in relationship with is asleep and is, you know, is shut down to all these things, you have two wise choices. One is to leave the relationship. The other is to be in an environment where if they choose to wake up at any time, then you're there with them, but you're not pushing them to go where they need to go. And I think it's a waste of time to be sledgehammering people and to say, come on, you've got to feel this. They can't. We can't when we're in these things.
Yes.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah.
Your book is titled Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which you say is the ultimate learning. Compassion is an interesting word to use. When it comes to mental health, compassion is often the last thing people are met with. I understand why it's necessary, but why is it so hard for us to feel compassion for people with mental health issues as opposed to physical? I don't understand it. Help me understand this.
If you see someone with a broken leg or a broken arm, then it's quite easy to go, oh, you poor thing, you know, like, which isn't very helpful communication anyway, but you're able to feel some empathy, or you see someone suffering with cancer or with some terrible illness, your heart might go out to them. Mm-hmm. I think with mental health, we're frightened of mental health issues. And I think as someone who was terrified, my sister Beverly had terrible mental health issues when we were growing up. She was in The Sound of Music on the West End stage. Susan George was my sister's understudy, and she had a serious breakdown. And in that moment, and she never fully recovered, in that moment, she was left adrift and in a terrible state of mental health. And I was terrified of what was happening to her. So I kept well clear, and even practicing as a psychotherapist, I used to pride myself on working with the worried well, or the sort of, like, you know, the normal neurotics. And I shied a million miles away from deep mental illness. And actually, the reality is that we have to overcome our fear if we're to really support and help each other. Yep. We have to overcome our fear. And rather than say, you know, what's going on with you, it's like, what happened to you? Then inquire, what is it that actually caused them to be in such distress?
Where's the line, Malcolm? Where's the line between us being quirky, you know, our own little, you know, peccadilloes, whatever, personality things, and something that is considered mental illness?
Well, it's interesting because I'm involved with something which we'll probably talk about later, Compassion and Mental Health, which has been an organization which I've been involved with for the last 5 or 6 years. Interesting, they contacted me soon after Melissa died and asked me to come and be a facilitator there, not knowing that I'd actually lost someone to mental health issues, so I'd lost someone to suicide. And there they have some great strategies and templates. One is, we do not label anyone. No one is a schizophrenic, no one is a manic depressive, no one is bipolar. People are working with what is. And I think we feel safe when we can put it in a nice comfortable box and go, ah, well, they're depressed. Ah, well, they're bipolar, or whatever it is. Then we can go, then that's the analysis. The diagnosis is often not helpful. Now, there is a line, as you say, Sandy, I think where is the line is important. I think there is a line where there has to be sufficient safety to be around that person. So if that person's likely to smash the house up, you know, it's not, you're not going to want to go, oh, well, you know, do whatever you want and I'm with you. So, but if we can learn to overcome our fear and to inquire with our compassionate hearts into what's going on for people, sometimes we can help them get through something, and sometimes we can create environments where they can be healed or at least go through their own healing process.
Mm. Yes. How do you feel about medication? I'm curious.
Well, interestingly, I used to absolutely hate medication, and I hated it for myself, even for the minor illness, you know, for anything. I never take paracetamol or aspirin, for example. But I have seen that medication, I worked in a medical practice for about 12 years in Lyme Regis, and I have seen that occasionally, sometimes, medication is really important. That actually, if someone is really spinning out and can't contain themselves, then I think it's probably really valuable to use a crutch for a while. The problem is with medication is that it tends to sort of create a fog and a cloud around us, so that we're not able to find our way through that, and we then lose touch with all the feelings. Yeah. I personally believe that if Melissa had been medicated before she in her second episode of this, 10 years after the initial one, if she'd have had some antidepressants and she wasn't sleeping, if she'd had sleeping pills, she was so determined never to touch medication again that actually I think that there's a line to be struck. And I think it's very dangerous to be anti-everything. Yeah. But it's also, we have to look at what's the medication for? What are we looking at? How can we support that person? What are the alternatives to the medication? What are the things that can go alongside the medication? What are the support groups that are possible?
Mm-hmm. Love that answer. I love it. Definitely beautiful.
So your first chapter, one of your first way in the book is doing the work.
Yeah.
What happens in the therapy room? What does happen in the therapy room? What kind of work are you doing, starting with?
Well, what I love doing is ongoing groups. And unfortunately, with the coronavirus, my ongoing group has been sort of like sidelined onto Zoom for quite a long time, but it's still in place. There's something about an ongoing group where we learn to practice the skills of authentic and honorable communication, and also learn how to give each other feedback, which can be received. So what happens in an ongoing group is we get to trust each other. We build trust structures in all sorts of ways. And then we get to look at what's going on. And often I'm listening to people's stories, and I'm not interested in the story. It's what's behind the story that interests me. So someone will be trotting out something they've trotted out 100 times before, and I'll go, hang on. Even the other day on with a client, he said something that was a cliche. I said, hold on a second. This was around his son's death. And I said, hold on a second. This is actually, that feels a bit too trite. What are you feeling? And then suddenly his feelings were there. So I'm looking for signs when I'm working in the group room. I'm looking for signs of something that's wanting to be penetrated, something that's wanting to go deeper down into where it can be. And then the group become a really supportive environment, in effect, a sangha, a community of like-minded others who are going to support them in the process of traveling the road that they're on and working with whatever it is they're working with.
It's like you're saying, I see you, I hear you.
Yes. It's exactly right, Rebecca, yes.
Yes, yes. And to me, that would make a person just kind of like someone really understands my soul, understands who I am.
There's a relief about really being got, really being understood.
Yes.
Yeah. It's because you can be your authentic self.
That's right. And then and also we're practicing and learning not to judge each other.
Right.
It's very easy to judge people. Oh, well, they're sick or they're screwed up or whatever it is we want to say. But actually we're practicing really seeing what's truly going on behind the masks and behind the disguises.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's important not to feel isolated. I mean, many people, if they're struggling, feel there's something wrong with me because I'm struggling and other people aren't. Being in a group and seeing that other people are struggling too makes it better.
Actually, it empowers us. When we see that other people are struggling and they're learning to cope with it, we get empowered. And then we feel more trusting about sharing the deepest stuff that's going on for us.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, you're listening to Crack the Podcast with me, Sandy Sedgbeer, and my co-host, Rebecca Shaper. And we're talking about suicide and depression with psychotherapist and author Malcolm Stern, whose book Slaying Your Dragons with Compassion offers 10 ways to thrive even when it seems impossible. After the break, Malcolm will share some valuable insights and tips on how we can help others and ourselves cope well with challenging situations. We'll be back in a few moments.
The Real Conscious Connection. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
Welcome back. Malcolm, one of the chapters in your book is called Tuning Into Your Radar. Can you explain what you mean about being in touch with your radar? Is this the same thing as intuition?
Yes, it is. It's really about that we have six senses and that we override our sixth sense, often in favor of logic. So we'll override the wisdom that comes through us in certain situations. Now, because I've been practicing running groups for 35 years, my radar is very finely tuned because I'm constantly staying very focused and looking for what's going on and having to sort of take paths that I wouldn't logically take, but that my instinct is guiding me to take. And time after time, I see that it's healthy. So what I realized is that actually all of us have a radar that we can refine. And if we can practice refining that sixth sense, we can start to trust it more. You know, it's that moment where you're about to step off the curb and suddenly something stops you and then a car whizzes around the corner, which you hadn't heard and hadn't seen. You'll be thinking of someone and they'll ring you. You'll think, oh, I must do that. And then suddenly that's what you have to do. So we're often getting messages from our wise self. And my understanding of that is do the work to develop the radar, to refine yourself. So meditate daily. Do things that are going to make you into a clearer vessel where things are not so muddy and we're not so full of thought all the time and there's time for instinct and intuition to come through.
Why do you feel some people don't want to tap into their radar? Do you think it's fear?
It's fear. You know, we trust the head. We just keep going with the mind, you know, like, if you do that, then you get that, and I don't need to look at that, or I don't want to feel the vulnerability. Yeah. And that's the thing. I don't want to feel the vulnerability that's about what it is to tune into the radar.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit or give a little bit more example about using your head versus your radar?
Yeah, we are very cerebrally based people. We like to think our way through, or we've been taught to think our way through things. Mm-hmm. Thinking it takes round and round in circles. And there's something about slowing down the thinking process and tuning into the other process, which is the feeling process, the intuitive sensing process, which can help us to find answers we wouldn't necessarily find under our own steam. And often we can think we're guided or we're inspired. And of course we are. And I've just seen that Michelle's put up on the chat box, inner voice. It's exactly right. It is the inner voice that is there that can speak to us, speak through us.
Do you feel deep breathing really helps that as well? A person just like does a lot of breath work that to help them tune into their radar as well?
I think whatever we can do that will slow us down, that will stop us from some racing thoughts, will help us get in touch with that radar. And I think the more we can find practices to do that, then the better we're going to be able to access that.
Hmm. One of your chapters is about finding your purpose. And, you know, many people struggle when they don't feel they have a purpose. You know, I've been there myself when I think, oh, what am I going to do next? And it's, you know, a strange place to be, but COVID has had a significant impact on young adults, those that can no longer, you know, go to university or take their school exams, who are feeling as if their whole future, their whole purpose has been taken away from them. How do we help them find purpose at times like these when the purpose that they were working towards isn't there anymore?
I think we have to adapt. We have to find ways of adapting. That, you know, for me, I'm not running groups at the moment except on Zoom. It's quite painful. I'm used to sort of like, you know, stepping into the magical circle and waving my wand and things happen. And I love it. And I'm inspired by it, apart from which it pays me. And so I'm not able to do that. But actually we can do, again, I've seen Michelle's put up Pray. There are ways of doing this. Purpose isn't just about our job. Purpose isn't just about what it is we're going to do. And one of the things I write about in my book, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, where is it there? There we go. One of the things I write about in my book is about a bus conductor, when there used to be bus conductors before most of your time, actually, but there used to be bus conductors. And this bus conductor would just joke and play with all the passengers. And the bus was like a beautiful environment. And I used to hope that he would be the conductor on the bus that I would catch every morning. Because I just loved what he brought. And so for him, the purpose was about creating good feeling in people. Our purpose doesn't have to be an enormous big one. Our purpose might be raising a family where we're actually sort of like we're not subjecting our children to the same cruelty as we were subjected to as children. Our purpose can be something quite seemingly small, but something we're investing in that means our world is enhanced and the world of people around us is enhanced by what it is we are. So now, as you say, with the universities in trouble and people maybe not getting jobs in the same way, about finding what it is that's there for us in this particular time.
And allowing your suffering to transform you, correct?
Yes. That's, again, one of the chapters in the book that actually we run away from suffering. We want to avoid it. We don't want so-called bad feeling. And what happens when you run away from suffering, when you suppress suffering, is you get depression instead. And there's something very beautiful about suffering. You know, when I look at what I've been through with Melissa, what I can see is that it actually deeply touched into my being and has had a radical effect on me. So much so that when I wrote the book, I felt, and I'm not particularly mystically minded, but when I wrote the book, I often felt that Melissa's spirit was with me. In writing this book, I felt like there was some guidance from, whether it be Melissa or my inner wisdom or the divine or whatever it is, I felt guided in the process of writing the book and actually of facing my suffering. And when we allow ourselves to face our suffering, then we find that the suffering can sometimes be modified, or there's an incredible learning that's in there as well that goes with the suffering.
Malcolm, do you believe in soul contracts? Do you feel she had a contract with you to take a deep dive in your soul, the hard lessons in life, in order for you to now do the work with more fierceness and meaning?
I love it, and I partially believe it, and I wish I fully believed it. And I think, yes, there is definitely some sense of that that speaks to me as well. I do find that sometimes we'll meet people And it's like we've known them forever.
Yes.
And then what is it about them? Well, perhaps they're part of our tribe. Perhaps they're part of our tribe beyond this earthly self. Mm-hmm. And actually we reincarnate in tribes. And I do feel that Melissa is part of my tribe. So I do feel like there was something that's happened between us, where there's a deep understanding. And I feel much more connected to her. Now, interestingly, can I tell you about a couple of dreams I had?
Yes, please.
So powerful. I was longing to have a dream about Melissa, and it just wouldn't come. I went to bed at night longing to get some message from her. Then after about 6 months, I dreamt that I'd found where Melissa was, and I telephoned her. And someone answered the phone, and I said, "Is Melissa there?" And they said, "Just a moment, I'll get her." And Melissa, in a very flat, dull voice, said, "Hello, Mum." I said, "It's not Mum, it's Dad." And she hung the phone up. That was the only dream I had for 2 years. Now, at the end of 2 years, I was in Thailand, and I had a dream again about Melissa. But this time, Melissa was a very vibrant woman. She was really full of joy and color, wore bright lipsticks, bright colors, you know, beautifully made up, hair was exquisite. And I dreamt that I was at a party. I went to a party and that Melissa was there talking to people. And she looked over at me and gave me this radiant smile. Yeah. And I was moved to my core. Now, that alone was extremely powerful. But the extraordinary thing was I rang my other daughter, Alex, and I said, "Alex, I just had a dream last night." She said, "So did I." And we'd had the same dream.
Oh, wow. I got tremendous goosebumps.
Yeah, me too.
She was tapping into both of y'all. Do you feel that?
Oh, no question. And actually what's interesting is this two-year period, because Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talks about 2 years to go through the grieving process. And I felt it was 2 years that Melissa was going through, whatever she was going through, to bring herself back to who she was at core, and that then she was able to reveal herself to me, and not just to me, but also to Alexandra.
I understand that. The soul contract, actually, that I had with my brother. So I totally understand and relate with exactly what you're saying, and I feel the audience here is as well. And this information you're providing is just so powerful.
Yeah,
it really is.
It's Melissa's gift. This information I'm providing is Melissa's gift. This is what I've gleaned from going through the process of mourning my dear death.
Yes.
Yeah. This is her gift to you, and to the world.
But and to me, yes.
Yeah. Some of the methods that you describe in the book focus on the practice of conscious living. Yeah. What do you mean by conscious living?
I mean, what are we doing with this life? You know, what's this life about? And I think this life is about becoming conscious. And this life is a journey where we're going to be confronted with lots of lessons. And we're either going to take the curriculum and learn the lessons, or we're going to resist them like hell. But actually, for me, there's something about trying to breathe slowly, to practice meditation, to practice living in a way that is compassionate and heartful with the people I come into contact with on an everyday basis, and the life story that I live on an everyday basis, and to try and bring it to a place where there is more consciousness. And for me, that brings me joy. When I feel like I'm attuned, then I'm living consciously and I'm living in alignment with my deepest morals and integrity and place of understanding.
Mm. Your approach involves finding where the heart is and helping individuals access their truth. What do you mean by finding where the heart is?
Well, there's the mind that will tell you all sorts of things, and there's the heart which will tune in. And
well, then you're talking about the radar now.
Now we're talking about the radar. That's where the heart is. The heart is with the radar.
Right, okay.
And when we actually have the heart in play, that's good, actually. I should have put that in the book, and I didn't. But that just clicked in for me. But actually, when we can tune in with our hearts, then we tune in at a much deeper level, and then we stop, then we lift the judgments, then we can see behind the facade or the mask that's being presented to us, and we touch in to the deep essence of every human being. At a deep essence, every human being is magnificent and it is imbued with spirit. It's just that we've built some very heavy stuff to stop that from becoming part of who we are, to hide.
Mm. Hmm.
Yeah. So tell us about the compassionatementalhealth.co.uk. Yeah. I mean, you said a little bit earlier. How did it begin and what is its purpose?
Well, there was a woman called Bridget Bowen, and she started Compassionate Mental Health. She'd been through a series of mental breakdowns in her 20s, and the psychiatrist had decided that she was incurable. And she went to Thich Nhat Hanh's community. Thich Nhat Hanh is a great Buddhist, one of the great Buddhist teachers, I'm sure you know. And she went to his community and learned to meditate. And she was able to heal herself of this mental illness, mental conditioning, whatever it was. Wow. She realized there were ways of dealing with this that were outside the normal medical model. And so her passion became about creating environments where other people who were struggling with mental health issues could be enriched by going to those places. So she started this series of gatherings, conferences called Compassionate Mental Health. And she telephoned me, I think it was in around 2015, 2016 maybe, and said she'd heard I was a facilitator and said, you know, I'm really interested in having someone hold the space for these gatherings. Would you be interested? And I said, yes. She had no idea about Melissa having taken her own life. And I thought I was going there to educate people about, you know, I was going to be the facilitator, educate people. But actually, the first gathering, there were about 100 people in Wales. And some of the people were in the mental health system still, some had been through it, some were doctors and psychiatrists who were part of it. There was a whole range of people. And we were like a gathering, a community of people with some very wise voices there. And I was so educated by people's attitudes towards mental illness. And I realized I was as thick as you could possibly be around mental illness. And I had a lot to learn. I had lots of experience around the psyche and psychological well-being, but I had very little experience around what was seen as mental illness because I was so terrified of it. And I had no choice but to face it because my daughter had been claimed by it. Mm-hmm. So Compassionate Mental Health for me was an amazing gathering where I met some extraordinary people. And I was able to have dialogues which were so deep and so educational. And there were normally 2 or 3 days of meeting, having workshops, of having large group sessions, of having small group sessions. And in that time, during those sessions, there was such deep sharing. And the work that I did running groups, I ran a group called Telling Our Stories. They were so profound, what people had been through. And people were able to share things that they'd kept hidden forever because they were so terrified of being judged harshly. And in the realization that they weren't going to be judged, a healing came across. And it's not all pretty please where you just tick the box and suddenly everyone's healed, but this was a step towards mental well-being that had been running, and has been now running since then. Unfortunately, we're not able to meet face to face yet, but we're looking to meet again when we can. And there is a website, compassionatementalhealth.co.uk, where you can read about this.
I love that word, compassion. It's a word, it feels like it's a word whose time is really now. Yes. You know, we've been so not compassionate for so long, with ourselves as well as with each other.
That's right. With us, you see, that's where it starts. It starts with ourselves. We judge ourselves. Yeah. Actually, if we can start to have compassion for this beautiful being that we are and realize that our lives have sometimes blocked us or molded us and have forced us into a place of despair or fight or flight or whatever it is, and start to come to some compassionate understanding that we are blessed and beloved. And actually, if we see that, we recognize that there are forces that influence us. And it doesn't have to be all mystical. It's actually most of the great spiritual traditions talk about the wise inner voice, the still small voice within us. And that's the place where compassion lives. And all of us have that. And occasionally, you know, I find meditation a very important part of my practice as a human being. Occasionally, I'll touch into the place where there is great joy in accessing the essence of who I am.
What would you say to someone who finds it really hard to feel compassion?
Yes.
I would ask questions. See, rather than try and educate them, I would actually try and get educated. I'd ask questions. What is it? When can you remember a time when you felt compassion? You know, what was it like for you as a child? And often you'll hear something like, well, perhaps they got beaten as a child and their compassion in them got blocked because they learned to step back from being who they were. Perhaps they were maltreated as as an adult. Maybe they were abused in relationships. And so that compassion itself had gone down. I think if you face and confront that in yourself, mm-hmm. then you can start to find where the compassion lives again as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the compassion and loving yourself just as who you are. Yeah, it's beautiful.
One of the 10 methods, another one of them, is about receiving the presence of others.
Yeah.
What does that look and feel like? And for somebody who is struggling and feeling very depressed, often they do not want other people around. So it's very hard for them to receive. How would we then present ourselves in a situation like that?
Well, probably the people they don't want around are the people who can't receive them. So there's almost like a defensiveness, and there's a place where you go, I'm not going there because I'm going to get judged, I'm going to get trashed. And that's why I started working in groups, that actually creating environments where people could be received. I'm not running groups at the moment because of COVID, obviously, but I am running groups for alternatives. I'm doing a three-part group on Sangha, on spiritual community in February and March. And I'm doing a three-part group on relationships with Conscious Cafe. So, I think there's something about being in groups that actually creates, when they're well run and when they're well held. Mm. It's about groups that creates a trust. Thank you, Michelle. She's just said it's about trust, and it is about trust. That creates trust. And then when there's trust, you can start to reveal the things that you're struggling with. Now, my advice to people would be find groups before you get to the place where you're in despair, because it's so much harder when you're really in the thick of it to reach out from there. And maybe when you're in the thick of it, perhaps you can reach out to the person who you feel close to, who can be part of your sangha, part of your network, and you can share with someone who you trust. So you start to trust the person where your radar is saying, this person can receive me. And you might want to ask some questions to see whether they can receive you. I'm going through something at the moment. Would it be okay to talk to you about this?
Yeah. You know, Byron Katie has this wonderful thing. When she used to go and give free talks, she would encourage the audience to get in touch with somebody who had, been a little bit trained in her work. And people would start these groups and they could continue to do the work in a circle group. And America was full of groups like that. Is there anything like that in England? Is anybody organizing something or supporting something like that? Because it sounds like people would say, Sangha sounds great, but, how do I start one or how do I get into one?
Well, interesting. I had a client who, I did a broadcast on Sky News.
And I saw that.
Only one person ever contacted me from that. And this woman sort of like said that she used to watch the news all the time and was, had some very strong spiritual experiences in the past, but had lost that. And so she came to me for therapy and we started working together. And she suddenly found that she had such an appetite for all these things. She started to be directed towards Jack Kornfield's meditation teachings, towards all sorts of things. And then I did a one-off on a launch for the book on alternatives, and I spoke about Sangha, and she'd said to me beforehand, well, I haven't got a Sangha. And interestingly, I put people into small groups, and she found a woman in her small group with whom there was such a space of simpatico between them. And they meet every single week and have been meeting every single week for many months now, where they support each other. And so I think it's not about having to find something amazing and magnificent and enormous. It's just about taking the risk with someone with whom you already have a sense that there might be something, and also trusting that the universe or that life will guide you to the right people as well. And that very often we resist taking the risk because we're risking rejection of showing ourselves with people. And I think that when in these times particularly, we're all struggling in these times. Yeah. You may be struggling less than others, but all of us are going through something, and we need Sangha, we need community. And Michelle's just said someone you click with, and I think that's right. It is someone you feel. Yeah. I have a connection with that person. A friend of mine, I was talking to today, and my friend said, oh, how's Julian? Julian's my flatmate who I used to live with, and I've moved recently to Totnes in Devon. And I haven't spoken to him for weeks. And my friend said, it's up to both of you to keep the relationship sustained. So just before I came on this, I rang him, and he was so pleased to hear from me. But we'd both been sort of coy about contacting each other. And actually, so we have to take risks with people who we know have got some heart connection that we can tap into.
You think part of that is the energy that you have with that individual?
Sorry, say that again.
Do you feel like part of that is the energy that you have? Yes.
Definitely. And actually, we develop that energy because when we open and we practice authenticity with others, it becomes that much more strong because then we don't want anything less. Now, I have a regular a dyad, a pairing with a close friend every Monday morning between 8:30 and 9:30. I have a pairing with my friend Nick, and it's on Zoom. And we take half an hour each, 20 minutes each, to talk about what's going on in our lives, whatever we want to talk about, and 10 minutes for reflection. And then we switch it around. And we've been doing that for about a year and a half, 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful place because we're feeding that connection together. These things don't just come from nothing. We have to work on creating structures that will support and nourish us. Mm-hmm.
One of the worrying things that I've observed since COVID is how people are getting so inured to, you know, being detached and distant from one another, that they're going more and more within themselves, which is not a bad thing, but at the same time, they're finding it harder and harder to connect with others.
Well, I think it's going in themselves in fear. Now, interesting, every day I take a walk on Sharpham Drive, which is a local beautiful walk around woods and a stream it's an exquisite walk, and sheep in the fields and you know, it's just magical scenery. And I was walking today, and I noticed how many people were walking like, you know, completely, because they're trying to stay safe, they're also staying out of relationship. Yeah. And then I noticed the people who would smile and say good morning. And I noticed the people where I felt there was some sense of heart connection. Yeah. And because we are having to stay isolated, doesn't mean we have to sort of shut our hearts down. And it's even more in our interests to smile at people, to open our hearts, to see people and see that they're there, make eye contact, smile, make eye contact, allow ourselves to be interested in another. It doesn't mean we have to have lengthy conversations. It just means tune in and connect.
Be open. We only have a few minutes left. It's gone very quickly. I know that Rebecca has a question that she wants to make sure we get in before we close.
Malcolm, in your view, what would be the ideal approach to mental? What would the ideal approach to mental health look like? That's what I'm trying to say.
That's a very good question indeed, because I have thought about this. Obviously, I think people would go into compassionate environments when they needed to, when they couldn't cope out in the world anymore. And those environments wouldn't be about drugging them so that they can hardly move and cause less problems. Those people would actually create a safe space for people to talk, to make contact in community. And I think R.D. Lang in the 1970s and Joe Burke, who set up the Arbors Association, where the therapists and the patients lived together in community and in environments. And that was extremely powerful. Now, Joe Burke is a friend of mine now. He's in his 80s. Mm-hmm. And he's a psychiatrist who has such heart. But I've met some psychiatrists who are so cold, who just know how to prescribe drugs but don't know how to meet the essence of an inner human being. Whereas Joe, his patients loved him because he was full of heart. And heart is what we need. We come back to that place of heart.
That's a perfect way to finish this show with that message. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. So, Malcolm, thank you so much for joining us today. And also thank you for allowing us to steal your title and add it to this show.
I feel like it's shared. It's shared. It's like I'm touched that you wanted to use it. Can I just say something about that title, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion? So I was listening to a song. Have I got half a minute or so?
Less than half a minute. You've got about 10 seconds.
A song which had the line, "Save the Dragons with Compassion," about 25 years ago. And I went, that's a great line. And I've been using it in my groups ever since, and I knew the book had to have that title.
Yeah. I love it. And thank you so much. It was so compelling. I've learned so much, and I love learning from people. And you definitely have a huge mark in the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Sandy. Lovely to see you guys.
And thank you to everybody watching. Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, 10 Ways to Thrive Even When It Feels Impossible, is available online and in bookstores. And you can download a free excerpt of today's show. Of Malcolm's book on crackedthepodcast.com website. You can learn more about Malcolm's work and his books, which include Falling in Love, Staying in Love, How to Build a Strong Lasting Relationship, at his website, malcolmstern.com. And if you're seeking support in the UK, check out compassionatementalhealth.co.uk. We'll be back at the same time 2 weeks from now. Till then, it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me, Malcolm. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely.
And remember, there's a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in.
That's where I got the sign.